this month's show, joining the dots with the Human Connectome Project.
The project will collect data from hundreds of adult healthy subjects about the structural and functional connectivity of their brains.
How many times did brains evolve?
We think that the brain only evolved once. We think that the last common ancestor of all the higher animals had already been equipped with a brain.
Plus non-conscious processing of emotions. There's a lot going on behind the scenes. Hello and welcome to Neuropod. I'm Kerry Smith. We begin this month with a real headache, or rather, a migraine. There are two main theories of how migraines are caused. Some studies suggest that they occur when blood vessels in the brain expand. Other scientists think that migraine is a neural disorder, a product of abnormal activity in certain brain networks. In this month's Nature Reviews Neurology, three migraine specialists consider the evidence. Here's one of them, Lars Edvinsson of the University of Lund in Sweden.
In the beginning, it was the vascular theory, which actually the UK guy Thomas Willis, 1700 something, he found nerve profiles on brain vessels, and then he suggested that migraine was a vascular disorder. This was supported later by American studies by Harold Wolff, when he found that the temporal artery was dilated in migraine patients, and that if he gave a vasoconstrictor such as ergotamine, this constriction was reduced and the symptoms relieved. The other was two guys, Gavers and Living, who were having this aura of migraine. It's just before you get the headache, there is, shall we say, visual aura when you get a blurred vision or something like that. So they were saying this is a kind of due to a brain storm, a cortical brain storm. So they were advancing that neural theory.
So you come down on the side of the neuronal explanation then, the fact that migraine is a neural disorder.
I have moved from the vascular to the neuronal.
And what makes you come down on the side of the neuronal explanation then?
Well, it's because the vascular theory cannot explain it. The other way is that you stimulate the trigeminal system and then you can have another something called neurogenic inflammation in the dura mater. And the dura is a connective tissue that sits inside of the skull bone and wraps the brain, protects it. And if you stimulate the trigeminal system, you can have inflammation here with release of plasma proteins and inflammatory mediators, but also vasodilatation.
And is this the system that scientists think is involved in the symptoms of migraine?
Absolutely. This is bringing in sensory information into the brainstem, and then it goes through the brainstem up to thalamus as a relay station.
And so the function really that's going wrong in migraine is correctly filtering sensory inputs.
That is actually the caveat of our hypothesis. We have normal inputs, and then because of a mutation in CNS ion channels, the excitability is a little bit more pronounced in migraineurs. So because of this, the incoming signal is not filtered good enough, and therefore you can elicit an attack. And the proven genes that we have available to us, they are all working on cortical excitability.
So none of them are involved in blood vessel dilation?
No.
So I suppose that must be another argument for the neuronal side. In your review, you highlight a particular protein called CGRP. What exactly is this protein and what does it do?
Well, there are several neuronal signals in nerves, and this one in particular seems to be involved in migraine. There are two types. One is alpha-CGRP, which is in sensory nerves, like in the head, but in the gut, the sensory nerves there, they have another form, beta-CGRP.
And is it just, you know, circulating during kind of normal life, and does it change its function during a migraine attack? How did you link it with migraine?
Well, I did a lot of basic studies during the 1980s, and then at one stage I met Peter Goadsby, and we agreed to do a series of studies in migraine patients and collected blood from migraine patients when they had their attack. Then we measured the peptide in the blood. it turned out that it was elevated, and we looked on many different signal substances in this blood. It was only CGRP that was elevated. When the pain disappeared, the CGRP level normalized. So it became rather strong evidence that pointed CGRP is very important in primary headache diseases.
And if it does have this central role then, do any current drugs work this way?
Yes. A few years ago, one German company made a drug called Olsegepant, and it was shown that it had an anti-migraine effect. The drug was a little bit old-fashioned, so it could only be given directly into the blood. And today, Merck has another one, Telcagepant, which is a CGRP receptor blocker, and it works very well in all the clinical trials that have been published so far.
And is migraine a kind of big industry for them, a big target?
Do you know how many people that have migraine?
No, tell us.
In the Western world, it's up to about 15%. But you could easily say that two-thirds of these can handle it with normal drugs like aspirin and so on. But two-thirds, they have more problem, many attacks which can knock them out several days every month. And they need something more helpful. And the triptans that we have, they have done a great job, but there is room for something new.
Lars Edvinson. Find that article at nature.com/nrneurol. Coming up shortly, how we process emotion without perceiving it. Freud would be pleased. First, though, we turn to brain evolution. And more specifically, how many times did brains evolve? Some organs, like the eye, are thought to have sprung up multiple times. Could the same be true for the brain? Detlev Arendt, an evolutionary biologist at the European Molecular Biology Lab in Germany, has some ideas. He and his team have been studying a little earthworm-like creature called a ragworm. At the recent meeting of the European Molecular Biology Organization in Barcelona, he told me more.
We have chosen that worm because we have many examples already that this worm has conserved features in its nervous system. So it tends to show ancient versions of specific traits, specific characteristics. Whatever we look at seems to be in a pretty ancient state. Yeah, so you might know that every region of the developing brain anlage, so where the brain develops, has a specific code of genes that are turned on in this region. And of course it was interesting for us to compare what we find in this worm brain to what is known for the vertebrate brain. And the surprising finding was that we found a lot of similarities.
Yeah, naively you'd expect our own brains are quite different from worm brains.
Yes, of course. I mean, our brains are much larger. Also, there was no clue that any of the specific structures that we have in our brain, and most prominently, of course, the cerebral cortex, that they would find any counterpart in these worms. But they do have, and it was known before, that they have some interesting structure in this brain which were worth some comparison. For example, these famous mushroom bodies. And these mushroom bodies, just by structure, were suspects to be somehow involved in sensory integration, maybe even association, to make sense of what the senses, like vision and smell, tell about the environment and translate it somehow into movement. So these brain parts were especially interesting for us because, by definition, they would be doing similar things like our cortex.
And how did you go about finding what you found, these similarities between the human cortex and the annelid brain?
The methods in this case have been the breakthrough, in that previously labs like ours, they have looked at single genes that were known to be important somehow in brain development. And the new thing now is that Raju Tomer in my laboratory has invented a new protocol to look at many genes at once. Usually we can only stain one embryo or one larvae with one gene. Maybe we can stain it for two genes, but not more. And he then realized that our animal model, so this annelid worm, early on during development, has a very stereotypical mode of development. It always develops the same.
It's across individuals.
Across individuals. So one individual of the same, say, age, develops exactly the same. And he thought, okay, maybe I can benefit from this observation for image registration, because then if the larvae look so similar, maybe it's even possible to align different larvae with a computer, superimpose them, and like this then get information about co-expression of genes without staining them in the same individual. And indeed it worked.
And you talked about molecular maps in your speech earlier today. You look at the molecular map for a worm and the same version of one for kind of a mouse, and you've said to yourself, well, these are too similar to have evolved independently.
Yes. So we looked at the worm map, and it was quite clear that the overall topography of this map, of the molecular regions that we detected in the worm, was very similar to the vertebrate one. So to understand this, one should know that regions are always defined in combination of several genes, several transcription factors that are specific for this region. So if one thinks about it, there is no specific reason why a specific region in the developing brain should be defined by exactly this combination of transcription factors. Yeah, so we think that here the patterns, the similarities in the codes of transcription factors defining similar regions in the same spatial arrangement is too similar to be of independent origin.
So do you think that the brain only evolved once in evolution?
Yes, essentially, yes. We think that the brain only evolved once. We think that the last common ancestor of all the higher animals, like us, so vertebrates or annelids, the ones we have looked at, or insects or nematode worms and so on, that this ancestor had already been equipped with a brain.
Do you find that surprising that that's the conclusion? Because things like the eye, for example, we can theorize that eyes evolved multiple times in evolution.
Yes, for eyes, the question is not settled in the same manner, I would say. For the brain, if one thinks about at what stage of evolution a brain should have come into place, all these worms and or vertebrates or insects and so on, they all have in common to be bilateral, to show bilateral symmetry. And it is very plausible that this bilaterality evolved so that organisms with a worm shape and bilateral symmetry evolved to do directed locomotion towards something. So this is what all bilateral symmetry is about. And if you do so, then it makes a lot of sense to have anterior in your new head, to have senses, to integrate the information that they gather and to translate it into movement. And this is essentially what we think this precursor of the cerebral cortex and the mushroom bodies and so on has done. So in a way it makes a lot of sense. But it is fair to say that there are many animal groups without a brain. So if there has been a brain in place, it is true that then the brain must have been lost in many evolutionary lines.
It does give a new meaning to the expression we have in English, to lose one's head.
Yes, this probably happened very frequently.
Imagine you had a detailed map of London and one of Manchester, but no road atlas or train timetable to tell you how to get from one city to the other. Well, neuroscientists are in this same position when it comes to mapping the way brain regions connect to each other. We know quite a lot about the brain's anatomy and quite a bit about the different cell types at the micro scale, but how these things connect up isn't clear.
The three-dimensional structure of the brain as an integrated organ has never really been possible to observe, even in animals. Even in animals, the data is always very fragmentary, either obtained under a microscope or one little piece of the brain at a time.
That's Van Wedien, a neuroscientist at Harvard Medical School. He's part of a team taking part in the Human Connectome Project. With more, here's Michael Herter, Associate Director of the National Institute for Mental Health and Director of the project.
The Human Connectome Project is a comprehensive and systematic project that will collect data from hundreds of adult healthy subjects about the structural and functional connectivity of their brains. And this will produce a large amount of currently missing but absolutely vital data about the human brain.
The project is funded by the National Institutes of Health, who this month gave out the first set of grants totaling $40 million. Two teams received this money. Van Wedien is co-directing one of them and has $8.5 million to spend.
Our team has worked over the last 10 years or so to develop MRI technology to map the structure of the connectivity of the brain. And we are building a new scanner that will do this considerably better than any of the existing scanners. The technology we're using is a thing called diffusion-sensitive MRI. Diffusion-sensitive MRI makes unusual demands on the scanner hardware and software. And so the existing commercial scanners are far from optimized for this purpose. By building a new scanner, we hope to achieve about a factor of 2 improvement in resolution and about between a factor of 5 and 10 improvement in sensitivity. If this were a telescope, it would be just about equivalent to doubling the diameter of the mirror.
The rest of the money, some $30 million, is going to a team from the universities of Washington and Minnesota. David Van Essen at Washington co-leads that group.
We will be acquiring data from a large cohort, a target number of 1,200 adults selected from a family register that includes twins and their non-twin siblings. And it's critical from our view in order to learn not just about the typical or average connectivity, but how it varies and how aspects of brain circuitry are heritable, what parts are heritable and what are less so. And ultimately, when we get to the end of the project, we will be doing extensive genotyping on all subjects, and having this large number will give us a good shot at learning about genetic contributions or influences on brain circuitry.
Ambitious stuff. The teams will use several different types of imaging technique to map their subjects' brains and provide information on which brain regions are functionally connected. This has implications for disease, because the brain's connectivity can be dysfunctional in some disorders. David Van Essen again.
We already have good indications that there are brain abnormalities, structural and functional, in autism and schizophrenia and many other disorders, but our characterization of those differences are very, I would call them, rudimentary and limited. They don't allow us to really understand what's gone wrong in many of these disorders, or to think about how better to treat or diagnose these disorders.
That part of the project is still a way off. First, you need good data from healthy brains, says Michael Herter.
Well, what we're doing in this project is collecting data from, healthy adult humans. And so this will really provide the foundation, the control data, or the data that will let us do some basic analyses against which future studies looking at these disorders can be compared and contrasted, if you will. So we're not really looking at disorders in this project, but one can imagine that if there are disruptions in connectivity in some of these other disorders, that depending on what we find, and we really don't know what we're going to find, such data will be useful for that.
Michael Herter of the NIMH, and before him, neuroscientists Van Wedien and David Van Essen. More information and some beautiful pictures at humanconnectomeproject.org. Now, even if you're someone who claims to be in touch with your emotions, you're still unaware of a lot of behind-the-scenes processing you're doing. Beatrice de Gelder studies the non-conscious perception of emotion at Tilburg University in the Netherlands. She and her colleague Marco Tamietto have written a piece about their field for Nature Review's Neuroscience this month. I called her to talk about it.
Over the last decades, scientists working in both in cognitive and more recently in affective science have become first very much aware of and second very much convinced that a lot of our processing, a lot of our perceptual and cognitive and emotional processing in that order is going on like really outside of our awareness. Of course, when I put it like that, that immediately evokes Freud's major thesis. And at this stage, there is absolutely no contradiction or opposition between the Freudian message and the message from current cognitive neuroscience or my affective neuroscience.
We must know a lot about it today that Freud didn't know in his time. What types of perception go on without our being consciously aware of them?
I would say pretty much all the important perceptual processes. I mean, the ones that get us through life on an everyday basis are largely unconscious. We process information all the time, like in driving, in walking through a door. I mean, our visual system is forever busy processing the parameters of our environment. And of course, all those processes are largely unconscious.
It seems as if scientists in this area might have set themselves quite a challenge, because it seems to me at first glance to be quite difficult to study things that I'm not aware are going on.
Yes and no. Of course, we have the Western tradition, which we may vaguely refer to as sort of mentalism, where our ability to judge what is or is not the case depends on our conscious access to make these kinds of judgments. But that's a view that Freud in his corner and contemporary neuroscience have largely invalidated. If you would have to be conscious of all the actions you need to take to get out of bed in the morning, very few of us would ever manage that.
That sounds like a great excuse for staying in bed. I'm sorry, I was just thinking about all the processing I had to do to get out.
Well, I don't know. I mean, all of a sudden you lay in your bed and you sort of contemplate the day and what's going on. And then all of a sudden you realize that you're actually stepping out of bed most of the time without having really put a timer on and actually made that decision.
But some of those processes are just, you know, swinging legs out of bed and things like that. Those aren't emotional processes.
Not emotional processes. At the face of it, they are not emotional processes. But I think we should, even in this case, be careful, because emotional processes are, of course, motivational. At core, they are motivational processes. So getting out of bed certainly is a testimony to your motivation to start the day.
Now, you talk in your article about the subcortical structures, the kind of brainstem areas,
yes,
and the lower order brain areas that deal with emotional processing that we're not consciously aware of.
Yes.
Could you talk us through some of the networks that are involved?
The most well-known, but not the only one, the most well-known, of course, is the amygdala. But there is also more ancient, equally ancient systems. Like, for example, we find in one of our recent studies that the periaqueductal gray, or PAG, is an important area, because it tends to lead us to automatically react when there is a threat of a menacing object or person in the environment. Other very important areas which that article focuses on are the different visual routes for processing information.
Surely if something's visual, then it's conscious.
So far, for reasons that I must say are far from being clear, there seems to be a consciousness associated only with the projections from the retina that go to striate cortex, to the main cortical visual area. People don't challenge anymore the notion that even in humans, those other visual routes are indeed contributing to our visual abilities. But somehow, for reasons we really don't understand yet, these projections are not associated with awareness of the visual processing that goes on, and therefore not with awareness of what we are actually seeing and doing. But that's very much still an open question, why that would be, that we have all those multiple visual routes and that only one so far seems to be associated with awareness of what we see.
Do you think that a stimulus might go through different pathways when we process it unconsciously as opposed to consciously?
Yes, that is certainly the leading picture of the current work that's going on.
And what might all this tell us about how the brain has evolved consciousness? Because it seems as if, you know, unconscious processing was what came first and consciousness has kind of been added on top.
Yes, that's absolutely. I mean, in the grand picture, that's certainly the one I would absolutely endorse, yes. Putting things in perspective, I mean, I would almost be tempted to say that the importance of consciousness has been greatly exaggerated, certainly for understanding the workings of the human mind. But consciousness is associated with accountability, with responsibility, etc., etc. But it should probably not have that dominant role in the study of human perception that it has had in the past.
That was Beatrice de Gelder. And that's all from me this month. There's more science news each week in the Nature podcast, and plenty of free audio, visual and textual goodness at nature.com/audio/video and nature.com/news. Get updates from me on Twitter, just follow @MinnieKerry. I'm Kerry Smith. Thanks for listening.